Hello everyone, Martin R. Schneider here from Political Theater. What you're about to hear are some interviews that we conducted for our last episode on unhealthy relationships and abusive relationships in film. We didn't get to use a whole lot of these clips and these answers in the episode, so we thought it would be nice as a bonus material for us to present the interviews uncut in their entirety. So first up, you'll hear me speaking to Jess Domokos, who is a human sexuality educator at Purdue University and an education outreach coordinator as well. And then afterwards, you'll hear Marta speaking to Christian Hayden, Kelsey Stewart, and Sharon Rice. They are community organizers here in Philadelphia who offer trainings to organizations and corporations and schools on how best to handle situations of sexual harassment or how best to handle relationship issues. So sit back, enjoy, and listen to these experts tell Marta and I what's what. Let's go ahead and start by you just saying your name and whatever title it is you'd like to be introduced as.
Oh, sure. My name is Jess Domokos. I am a sexuality educator. I teach human sexuality at Purdue University, and I'm also an education and outreach coordinator.
Okay, Jess, how do you define consent?
That's such an intense question. So I think in general, the way that we talk about consent is very black and white, and I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think it's really important to acknowledge that there are shades of gray. But
50 of them?
I'm sorry?
How many shades of gray are there?
Oh, God. 50, I hear. Terrible. So my definition that I like and that I teach to folks is that consent is an active process. It's a process of informed and enthusiastic agreement to participate in something. So like in this case, we're probably talking about sexual or romantic activity with another person. Consent is usually shown as being given by not opting out of something, but I like to teach people to opt in rather than just remain silent and not opt out. I teach folks that it's the consent is the presence of yes, not the absence of no.
Cool. That's a great answer. So when you're talking with your classes, what are some of the more outlandish or outrageous myths that you've heard about healthy relationships that you've had to debunk with them?
That's really hard to answer. I'm not sure that I can really answer it, to be honest with you. I feel like just by introducing new information to them all the time, I'm constantly dismantling a lot of just deeply ingrained nonsense that we pick up throughout our lives. And they don't always share it with me when some crazy thing that they misunderstood has become clear to them. I can tell you that I focus a lot on teaching them to be critical consumers of media and information and to question everything, including me. They actually do, their final paper for the semester is to do a media analysis. So I assign them a movie to watch and they have to analyze it for themes that we've learned about in class, including relationships.
Okay, so let me ask that a different way then. Where do you think these ideas, these things that you debunk with them, their ridiculous notions, where do you think those come from? Where do those ideas appear in their head before they walk into your class?
Sure. So definitely we get some of that information from the people around us, right? We see our parents' marriages or family or friends or whatever, but a lot of it, especially in this day and age, comes from movies and television media. And books, I suppose, but to a lesser extent, because who reads books anymore, right?
Right. Mm.
Actually, the next question was, what role does the media play in people's understanding of relationships? So I guess I'm just going to say more about that.
Oh, sure. It plays an enormous role. I mean, when it comes to relationships, we learn the, like, rules of the road through observation. So we develop these deeply ingrained social scripts that dictate things like, I don't know, who pays on the first date, or how long it should take you to get over a breakup, or what it takes to help a partner orgasm.
So we're talking about some movies that and books and other things that are considered extremely romantic, or marketed as extremely romantic, I suppose, like Twilight or 50 Shades, The Notebook. We're also going to talk about the Han Solo, Princess Leia relationship in Star Wars, because this isn't just about, like, what's advertised to women.
Nice.
So why is it that you think we see abusive or unhealthy behavior often shown as romantic or sexy or desirable? Why is this a popular idea? Is it just because it comes from Harrison Ford and Ryan Gosling, or is there something else to it? Why do audiences respond to that?
So I am not a historian by any means, but I think that where that comes from goes back pretty far in the history of humanity. Like, humans naturally form connections with other humans. And there was a time where there were actual damsels in distress, right? There were, like, people genuinely at risk of being harmed, and there were actual acts of heroism to save those people, which has been romanticized. And, of course, there are actual acts of heroism every day, but not in the lives of most of us. So I think that we've romanticized those things quite a bit, and now we kind of have to manufacture them. And I think that we get that fix from movies and television a lot. Mind you, that is just my theory on it.
That's a good theory. I haven't heard that before. All right. So what are some healthy strategies that you suggest for people who have maybe fantasies and they wish to consensually and safely live out these sexual fantasies, these remote romantic fantasies, ones that contain potentially dangerous behaviors?
I love this question so much. Educate yourself constantly. I think a lot of people make the mistake of seeing a movie like 50 Shades of Grey, for example, and going out and buying all the gear without doing any research into how to do it safely. In the kink community, there's a big focus on risk awareness. And what that means is making sure that you understand the damage and the danger that is inherent in whatever you're doing. That's part of what makes it fun, right, is that there's some risk to it. But it's important to educate ourselves. And exploring our fantasies and bringing them to life is amazing, and it's worthwhile, but it takes work. And it's important to mitigate risk as much as possible, particularly if we're playing something with something that has an air of danger to it. Like, you know, manufacturing that heroism and bringing the romance back.
All right, last question, the one I gave you last night and you were mad about.
Yeah, I hate it.
Yeah, so can you give me an example of a piece of media that's doing it right that shows, like, a healthy example of people getting together?
So I spent a bunch of time thinking about this last night, and I had a really hard time with it. So I'm not sure that I can think of one that I feel is a really good example. I know we talked a little bit about Friday Night Lights, and you told me I can't use that example. So
yeah, I told you couldn't use Eric and Tammy. You could still use, like, Julie and Saracen.
No. Oh, God. Like, that relationship isn't problematic, please.
They're the worst. Matt Saracen is the worst. But if your choices are Matt Saracen or Tim Riggins, just leave. Just,
yes.
Just move the fuck out of Dylan. Date Tyra or something.
Oh my God. Yep, agreed. Yeah, but I think I'll just restate what I said to you yesterday, which is the fact that we struggle so much to think of a positive example of healthy relationships in media is the problem right there. Like, that sums it up. The fact that I had to spend a bunch of time trying to think about that and I really struggled is part of the problem.
Yeah, I've been thinking about it for weeks. We asked a couple of other people the same question, and some of them cheated and said Barack and Michelle Obama, which...
that doesn't count.
No, it doesn't count. Those are real people.
Yeah.
They seem to have a wonderful relationship, but yeah, those are real people. It doesn't count at all.
Right. I agree. So, like, part of the reason why Coach Taylor and Tammy came to mind right away is, like, you see them struggle. You see them disagree with each other and argue and, you know, have some issues, but they're always respectful of one another. Even when they're fighting, you can tell that they love each other in a way that is very healthy and very intentional. They communicate very carefully, and they're never, like, contemptuous or cruel to one another, which is something that we see in a lot of relationships in media.
Yeah, and I love that example, and I was able to come up with a handful of examples of, like, couples that I enjoy watching in media. If you're not watching This Is Us, by the way, Randall and Beth Pearson are filling that Taylor-shaped void in my heart right now.
I will have to check that out. I haven't seen it yet.
All right, but like I said to you last night, I figured out that the vast majority of them, the couple is already together at the beginning of the movie. Like, we walk in and they're already married, so there aren't that many examples of people getting together, meeting each other, that seem to be super healthy.
Yeah.
You know, which is surprising and dangerous, because you have to do that in order to get to the healthy couple part.
Yep, that's a very good point. I know, I spent a bunch of time thinking about that too, and I couldn't... For some reason, the thing I kept thinking of was, have you seen New Girl? The New Girl?
Yes, yeah. We might talk a little bit about New Girl, actually.
That's funny. I was thinking about that, but I couldn't make up my mind if I felt like that was a good example or a bad example. Like, there are some... Their communication skills are shit, but there are some great things that happen in that show as far as showing different ways of relating to one another. Some that are good and some that are bad.
Yeah, New Girl's kind of hit or miss. New Girl likes to do this thing, because it's written by men, where it, like, makes fun of the idea of asking for consent. Like, there's a bit, where Cece and, Max Greenfield, what's his name? Cece and Schmidt. Cece and Schmidt make fun of Winston for the idea of asking a girl to kiss her.
Yeah. Terrible.
It's I'm like, that's not healthy. But then there's other things, like you said, that are, like, I really like the Cece and Schmidt relationship in general. But that actually, like, leads into something that I want to talk about, like, the idea that you can fix somebody through a relationship, which I think is super prevalent. And I know I didn't tell you about this, but, like, this is super quick. And like, where do you think that idea comes from, or why is that a popular method or notion that people can be fixed? If you love them hard enough, they will stop being horrible.
Oh, God, where does that come from? I have no idea. I mean...
But it does exist.
What's that?
But it does exist, right? Like.
Oh, absolutely. That definitely... That's a huge, huge part of a lot of those romantic films is, like... I mean, look at 50 Shades of Grey. Like, Anna thinks that she can influence Christian to the point where, like, he's fixed. After all of the, oh God. And I mean, another huge problem with that movie is not only the representations of, frankly, an abusive relationship, but just the reinforcement of the concept that you can't have sexual diversity and interest in kink without being abused or being broken in some fashion, right?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
His whole background is, he was abused by an older woman when he was younger, and that's why he is the way he is, which is just fucking ridiculous. It's not true. Normal people are kinky. It's totally fine. Whatever weird, fucked up shit you're into is totally normal and healthy and natural, as long as everyone involved is consenting and being as safe as possible.
crowd around. That way we can hear one another. Okay, so my first question for you guys, and this will be edited around so the questions, you won't really hear them. During your teen years, what movies and TV shows did you view as ideals of relationships that you wanted to have?
I guess I would say I watched The O.C. a ton, and I think it was a bunch of examples of things I knew were crazy and I didn't want in a relationship, but I would also say the adult-parent relationship for the character that Adam Brody played, I thought was pretty balanced, supportive. So for me, when I was growing up, that was like the only show I watched as a teen.
You know, it's like I can't think of any, which I think is probably like indication of itself. Like I can't think of relationships that I saw on the screen. I was like, I want that. They're like funny examples, I think, that sort of were like, you know, kind of a dynamic, like from Martin, Regina and Martin.
Yeah.
Their relationship was really interesting in a kind of way. But speaking of that, also another comedy, there's a, it's one of the Waynes. It's not like the, there was a Waynes and he had a show, like, I forgot, it's his family's in the house and like, the dynamic between his wife and him and
yes,
show.
My wife and kids.
Yeah,
I love that show.
Okay.
Yeah,
such that
a good show.
Sense, right? So that was an interesting dynamic. But I can't think of anything like I used to watch OC and also like Dawson's Creek. And the thing about Dawson's Creek is I love the intro.
Yes,
but that's it. I didn't know how fast they talked. But that was it. Like I didn't pull anything. Like this is what I wanted. Or, like so, but those were the examples that I saw of sort of dynamics and ways that people break down and conflicts and certain, yeah, so.
Yeah. How about you, Sharon?
Yeah, I mean, I watched so much television when I was growing up, so I have, like, this massive cross-section that it involves, like, Disney movies, Looney Tunes, The Cosby Show, but then I also had a lot of these, like, political shows like The Jeffersons or like All in the Family and then like Full House. And so there was always sort of this idea that, you know, I guess the ideal relationship for me would be one that was sort of fighting the good fight to stay at the top or to stay where you got yourself. But then also, you know, very idealized where the woman in sort of the Disney film, she's the princess, she gets rescued, the man is really amazing and he's supposed to do all these things. So yeah, I think as a teenager, I kind of grew up with that and then sort of dove into things like My So-Called Life. So I got very angsty and very, what does it all mean? And what's the existential question about relationships and who should I be in that? So, yeah, I think my my point of view about relationships definitely ran the gamut between, like, ideal and then maybe sort of realistic, but never really having a solid understanding of what that realistic picture was.
Yeah. Well, on the flip side, now that we're all adults, what TV shows and movies and on-screen relationships in general do you think are getting it right when it comes to portraying relationships?
I'm not sure. I don't have a strong answer for that.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that growing up, my parents have a really strong relationship, and I think that really, they were also sort of have a storyline that's pretty star-crossed, and I think that was something I was expecting, and as I'm an adult, I'm maybe anticipating that it won't feel so destined in the end, like it might just feel more normal than the example that I had, the strongest example I had are my parents, so sort of just anticipating that change, and so I'm not sure necessarily in media, I was saying what I see on media, like a lot of people, like Barack and Michelle Obama, you know, sort of being an example, which is also goes completely against what I was saying about realistic, you know, sort of thoughts and processes with that. But anyway, so.
That's sweet.
Yeah, it's really, they have a really sweet story. It's,
I mean, I guess for me, I really liked Insecure, which I thought it really did a really good job of balancing kind of like what's going on socially in the world and how that kind of impacts who we are in relationships and what we struggle with and kind of like deal with, and it's really funny. So it was, for me, like, that's the best one. I also, full disclosure, I don't really watch a lot of TV, so it's difficult for me. But on the other hand, there's a movie called Pariah, which, like, kind of in a similar way for me, like, for Moonlight, is that it shows how difficult just being, like, who you are can be. And then, like, when you add, like, trying to be that, discover who that person is, and then also connect with someone else, and, like, how, like, amazingly difficult that is, it's just, like, for me, like, that makes me appreciate, even as a straight, you know, a straight male, black male, you know, that makes me really appreciate, like, how much energy and time and work and effort, like, being in a relationship is. Like, from those stories where, like, it's, like, it's beautifully depicted, but it can just unimaginably difficult, you know, in the face of all those things. And then some people still do it. So, yeah.
Yeah, I have to kind of piggyback on, like, Kelsey and Christian a little bit with their examples. I think at the top of my example is the Obamas. This is, you know, sort of like what I'm hoping for. And then I think somewhere in between there's, you know, I would definitely say Insecure is one of the shows that sort of tapped me as, wow, this is sort of really realistic, and this is kind of what I think black women are dealing with. And as a black woman, I sort of really identified with that show in a variety of ways. But then there's also, like, Master of None, Aziz Ansari's show. I really appreciated the way he kind of showed the dynamic of, you know, both your intimate romantic relationship juxtaposed against your best friends. So I think that, you know, as adults in the 21st century, we really are recreating the idea of family with, like, friends. And I know for me personally, my family has become my friends because my family is so scattered, and so my friends really are the people I go to for those sort of familial advice, and they come from a plethora of backgrounds, so, and we're all bringing our own sort of opinions on our own shows. So for me, I think shows that depict the relationship sort of birthed in these really well-established, really well-intended and very meaningful friendships, that's kind of like how I see media portraying, I think, a more realistic version of what it means to be in a relationship, and then trying to navigate all the intricacies and idiosyncrasies of people and figuring out who are you in that and how that plays out.
Up again. All right. Next question is, as educators for teens, young adults, and adults in the workplace, why do you think so many unhealthy relationships are being portrayed as desirable? Things like, you know, Fifty Shades of Grey, Twilight. Like, why are abusive relationships being put forth as romantic or, like, sexy? And anyone can jump in at any time.
I think for me, I feel like there's sort of two things happening around, like, bad, like, unhealthy relationships and then potentially abusive situations. So you have reality television shows like The Bad Girls Club that sort of depict a type of person, right? And that person reacts violently, aggressively, and everyone gets to watch that, and it's that's sort of who that person is. And then you have shows that depict, well, if you can sort of tame yourself, this is what a tamer version of an unhealthy slash potentially abusive relationship could look like. And I think I'm not really sure if that, you know, that the line between those two things is very clear, but if for me, I see sort of the transition from this is who you are as sort of an outrageous adult, and then when you're stopped being outrageous, you get more sophisticated in your outrage, and you can kind of hide it at home. And so I think it just sort of perpetuates this idea that as long as you're consenting at some point, maybe it's okay, but then there's never really a point that says none of this is okay. You know, I remember teaching teenagers around when the whole Chris Brown Rihanna thing happened, you know, having female clients or just, you know, people I was talking to say, oh, it's okay if Rihanna had hit Chris Brown. So that would have been fine because she's a girl. And I think culturally there is this idea that certain things are okay based on gender. So I think there's a lot of that kind of gets played out in sort of reality TV and then makes its way into sort of these romanticized versions of what it would be for someone who's violent to be able to be in a romantic relationship. And I personally, I feel like that's kind of where it goes, but I'd have to, like, I think, look more into it. Yeah. That's a great point.
Yeah.
I guess I could say I think that to a certain extent there's a fantasy around being someone, like there's like an intense passion or hyper focus on someone. And so in reality, if, you know, in Twilight, being like the sole focus of somebody, or in 50 Shades of Grey, which I think is the same storyline, sort of just being that hyper, like someone having their, all of their attention on you is sort of romanticized. And it's sort of an extreme version of that, just because, like, in story, you know, in stories and movies and TV, you sort of want that sort of fantasy feel. And I think that it's also based a little bit on reality, because people do like to be the, you know, I do like it when my partner thinks about me. I wouldn't like it if it was that extreme, but they sort of just highlight that and sort of focus in on that.
I guess I think that sort of violence is kind of like, is pervasive, just in kind of the different forms it can be, from sexually, emotionally, and physically, I mean, and then economically. So in a sense of like how we interact with people is like violence is normal. And that, like, of course that bleeds into our relationships and how we see and sort of connect to each other. So yeah, I guess it doesn't surprise me that those messages kind of sort of filter through. And they filter through, and I think, like Kelsey said, in a way that's sort of like, it's normalized, or like, this is kind of what I imagine that I want, because it's presented in this way, or it's like through this lens. And so even, you know, I think 50 Shades of Grey, in that sense, I think the focus isn't on the relationship, but really the way, the vehicle as to tell the story about this, like, sexy story, right? And so if you want to have a conversation or really have something to explore, it's like a relationship and, like, what it means to be in a relationship. And I think, you know, you have to offer other things. But that's not, like, how Hollywood or, like, pop culture works. It's, like, the things that are sort of looked at and chased are the things that kind of get, you know, sort of become the examples, even though that's, like, wasn't there, I don't think, was their intention, or, like, why, the reason why they exist.
And I think it's sort of, like, not a new concept that is happening. It's not just 50 Shades of Grey. It goes back, like, Romeo and Juliet or Helen of Troy, like, you know, just, like, long-time examples where that's sort of the driving force is something that wouldn't be healthy in real life.
Well, there's also, like, movies like Beauty and the Beast, which is about to come out again. There's the idea of this girl sacrifices her freedom to be with this person, but it's okay because he stops being a beast at one point. And it kind of furthers the idea that it's okay if they treat you a certain way at the beginning, because they will change. And I think that's also a harmful thing of, like, this is just temporary. But with a lot of these relationships that we see, it's not temporary. It's something that starts gradually, and then it keeps going until somebody leaves or somebody gets hurt really badly or dies.
Yeah, I think that intimacy oftentimes in relationships gets depicted as, if a person is aggressive in some way, that it's our responsibility in that intimacy to sort of hold their emotions and their extreme emotions as our responsibility to fix and or change. Mm-hmm. And so there's this idea that if you're staying, that means you're a good person, you know, something like that. That means that you are doing it right. And I think sometimes we're not often told that we can actually focus on ourselves and know what's good for us and know what's good for our own sort of truth in that relationship. I think those examples have been around for centuries, for men and women in a lot of different ways. It's okay for this to happen, not okay for this to happen, but when the bad things happen, make sure you're staying and trying to make it work, because to be alone is almost looked at as like an epidemic. You know, like, it's not okay to be single, which really is obviously not true. It's totally okay and totally healthy, and you can have completely meaningful and fulfilling life until you find the person that you're able to be with, or if you want to be.
That was awesome. All right. Now that you are educators who train others on how to identify abusive behaviors and set boundaries and how to safely help somebody who's in a violent relationship, what are some of the biggest relationship misconceptions or myths that you've come across when you're teaching your students? And are there misconceptions or myths that are harder to kind of shake than others? Sharon looks like she's like, I got something.
I think I'm gonna defer to my other friends in the room first.
Yeah.
I get the sense like that really like a deep conversation like on masculinity and what toxic masculinity and how that shapes a lot of the ways that our students like look at relationships.
What is toxic masculinity?
So the sense that like how one believes that a man should act like or sort of express whatever emotions or sexuality in such a way that it's like toxic and damaging to the to society or to relationships to other people, and so it's like you can hear the semblances of it or sort of it becoming formed and sort of like young people when they express, oh, like men can't get hurt, like either be emotionally or physically, that can range that answer, but there's still a sense that men shouldn't be as susceptible to hurt. There's just a sense of how I'm trying to think of some of the things I heard from my high school students.
Well, just as an example of what you're saying, the one card we use in an activity about your partner calls you too sensitive is always a breakup point for the young guys. And it's not because their partner's saying it's not because their partner isn't respecting their feelings, it's just being called too sensitive. It's just sort of the idea there is like a masculinity being presented in one way.
Yeah. I think about sort of some of the older trainings that we've done and how men wrestle with what it means to be a man, and how that, from finances to like, thinking about how childcare, instead of the role that should take, instead of like quote unquote, women's work, and it's really it's different whatever communities you work with, spaces you go to, what kind of like creeps up, and I think across the board, I would say like, that has been a thing that has like kind of like, shown to be, I guess. Something we need to figure out how to deal with in this work. It sounds obvious, but it's also like, to see it on the ground. And it also, because like, in a very much like, we think about what cultures, the sort of values that they have, and what it means to uphold them, and what happens when they can't uphold them. And then like, how that can affect the people around them, people closest to them. Right, so if you have men who believe that what it means to be a man is to have a job and to be able to support their family, and they are not in a position to do that because of sort of social structures and things of that nature and mass incarceration, and so you have a situation where they have to find other ways to exert power and control. And that's not to say that desire to exert power and control comes from men, and it also comes from women. And I think that the reasons why that happens, and I think it's like a different source. Like I think it's from, some of the like young women that I've worked with and talked to, sort of like this. I guess I don't know. I can't really describe the other side yet. But in 3 months I'll be able to tell you. But the masculinity part has stood out to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think, in my sort of training with adults, and most of the adults that I train are professionals, so they're sort of working with folks who have gone through an abusive situation. And I think the question for professionals is, what is it about the behavior that needs to change in order to make the relationship sort of stand out to the person who's being abused as abusive? And then I think for the few folks who have been participants, it's, I kind of hear a lot of things around spirituality and, you know, sort of what Christian had touched on about that sort of gender role and what does it mean to be a man, what does it mean to be a woman, and this sort of understanding that, yeah, at some level when someone wrongs you, it's not okay, but at what point does that wronging become abusive? And I think it's just teaching and understanding what does it mean to be abusive. I don't know that our culture really talks about abuse as a thing that exists. It's often peripheral to the rest of the situation. You know, just dialing back to 50 Shades of Grey, it's like it. Someone could look at that relationship in that movie and that book and say it's abusive, but the wealth, the sort of romanticized way in which the relationship is depicted kind of diminishes the fact that they might be abusive. And so we really kind of in some ways are judging books by their cover and then determining whether or not a person who has that cover could actually be abusive. And that plays out in things like socioeconomic. It plays out in race and gender and on and on and on. So, I think it's one of those ever evolving questions. And the answer also has to go along with it. But to normalize at least being able to, well, maybe not normalize it, but maybe just putting it out there that abuse happens. And it's not indicative of only one type of cover. There's many, many people who can become abusive. I think kind of starting there, it seems like a narrative that needs to begin.
Great. I guess working with young people, sort of important to think about how the world they grew up in is different than the world we grew up in, and the world they're existing in is also different. And so certain behaviors that we would feel really startled by are comfortable for them. I'm thinking mostly about information sharing with passwords and, you know, checking their partner's phone, which would feel very super invasive. And sort of as a trust issue, sort of seems normal to the vast majority of students that we interact with. So I guess there's just a balance in having them sort of learn that on their own, but also recognizing that maybe, you know, in their sphere, that feels fine. So I don't know if that answers anything.
It's good. Does anyone have any follow-up things on that before we go to the last one? All right. Last question. What is the most important piece of relationship advice that you give to your students, whether they're teens, adults, and everybody in between?
I guess the most important piece of advice that we give is just that each relationship is unique and that it's important for them to think about their own boundaries and needs in a relationship and to communicate those, and that there isn't one right or wrong way to do a relationship.
I don't think it's advice, but I think it's something that I think we try to lead them through to varying degrees of success. But trying to lead folks to like specifically think about what are ways that they can support their partner physically, emotionally, sexually, economically, and then like digitally, just to like finish off the few, so that as to like, you know, because we can talk about the like, you know, types of abuse and what they look like. But I think if we don't talk about the other side, then we leave, you know, students just as handicapped, right? To think about that. So, and there's a couple ways we do that. Sometimes we have them write a poem that's like we call it My Partner Poem. It's like, I'll treat my partner, my partner will be, and so like imagining what kind of characteristics or things that they want from their partner, and how they will treat them, how they'll touch them, how they'll see them, how they'll hear them. And then they go on the other side and say, I will be, and what kind of things that they'll exhibit in a relationship. And then, like, what they will do, how they'll touch their partner, see their partner, hear their partner, right? And how they'll connect, right? So, and I think that's probably the most important thing that we do. I do. Not really advice, but kind of like a leading of through an exercise.
I like that idea. It's an exercise of here's your wish list or things that you could be doing. I like that.
Yeah,
I think it comes down to helping people sort of see their own values in a relationship and what they're bringing to a relationship, and then also helping them to sort of work through some of the biases that might lead to not understanding that perhaps their own behavior is abusive or that they're witnessing something that's abusive, and sort of teaching around what does it mean to be abusive. I think those are sort of the three kind of areas and hubs that I sort of gravitate with the folks that I'm teaching and training, and hoping that there can start like a really meaningful dialogue and discussion around, you know, what does it mean to be abusive? And, you know, back to what I was saying before, you know, that narrative and really beginning to start the conversation around abuse happening and that it does occur. And these are some of the ways that we've seen it. And just helping them to kind of like identify that and know how to support the folks that they might be friends with or have been a family with who might be experiencing that, and how to talk to them about it.
Great. Was there anything I did not ask you about that you feel moved to share at this point?